Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the expected conviction in the same Moscow court that railroaded oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky of the three young women of the punk rock group Pussy Riot. Nina Khrushcheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and author of the forthcoming book The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulags of the Mind, joins us to discuss a trial Khodorkovsky has described as a medieval inquisition. Then we'll assess the meeting that took place today between the embattled Syrian dictator and Iran's national security chief Saeed Jalili, who pledged Iran's support for its vital partner. Nada Hashimi, a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics, joins us to discuss what Iran can do to save the Assad regime and what is likely to happen to the captured so-called Iranian pilgrims rumored to be members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. Then finally, we will look into the world's largest operator of private clinics and hospitals, the Hospital Corporation of America, HCA, that again is under scrutiny for performing unnecessary and expensive procedures that endanger patients and defraud the taxpayer. Dr. Evan Weissman, a retired cardiologist, joins us to discuss the latest charges against HCA, who previously paid out $1.7 billion in fines for defrauding the government in 2000. And joining us now is Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, and she was a research fellow at the School of Historical Studies of the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton University and served as deputy editor of East European Constitutional Review at the NYU School of Law. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She is currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you.
And these three young women of the rock group Pussy Riot, which I have to say is, I think, one of the cleverest names. You're forced into saying it all the time. And, you know, we're constrained here by six words we can't say, but that apparently is not one of them. The prosecutor in the case, who's asking for, I think, a three-year jail sentence today, described these young women as dangerous feminists. How does that strike you?
Well, that says it all. I mean, Russia in the 21st century talks about protest and dissent and very clever wording of these three very young women as dangerous feminists. I mean, you know, and Vladimir Putin's reaction is also very interesting, because when he commented on this, he said that in some other places, this woman wouldn't even get to the lawyer or to trial because they would be prosecuted immediately, basically getting death. And that just says it all, because Russia clearly sees itself not as a country, modern country of the 21st century, which I want to remind everybody is situated in Europe, but the country of some medieval makeup, that we're still comparing ourselves to very backward patriarchal systems where women and their freedom of speech is considered to be very dangerous.
Well, it also paradoxically has echoes of the Republican primary campaign, where Rick Santorum was making similar statements. I mean, I understand your analogy to, say, Russia comparing their legal system to that of Saudi Arabia, where these young women would have already been beheaded. But that's that's hardly a yardstick of civilization.
Right. And it's, of course, it's hardly an original statement either. But we just have to remember also that Rick Santorum dropped out of the campaign and is basically is a distant memory at this point. And in Russia, it is the president of Russia who has been in the Kremlin or around the Kremlin for 12 years now makes this kind of statement. So not that these things do not exist in other countries or in the United States, for that matter, but there is still a choice, and there is a kind of counterbalance, at least in the, certainly in the United States. And in Russia, there is no counterbalance because these women can be sentenced to 3 years tomorrow. In fact, tomorrow, apparently the judges, it is said that she's ready to make a final decision. So I think that is the greatest distinction, that we have it coming from the legal system and also from the president of the Russian Federation.
And, of course, this judge, Nina Kresheva, refused to allow any mention of Putin in the trial, even though the young women are, in many ways have protested against him.
Oh, and the whole and that song that they were singing is all about Putin, that he's afraid of protests and Mother of God, please take Putin away. It is a feminist prayer, so to speak. And exactly, and that makes it even more farcical because it's a huge elephant in the room that we are not supposed to mention by name, but we do know what the conversation is about and what the whole story is about.
Well, as I mentioned in the opening, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was railroaded by Putin for daring to engage in politics in Russia, he described this trial as a medieval inquisition. Apparently, he at least has a website. And that leads me to that is the last hope, isn't it? I mean, everybody in Russia gets pro-Putin information in the press. There's virtually no other newspaper, except for, I think, Novaya Gazeta, that prints anything like the news. And then you've got all of television controlled by Putin. So the last frontier of information seems to be the internet. And Putin is moving on that.
Well, that is actually not entirely true. Some of it is. Putin controls the TV. He really doesn't control the news, or he doesn't really care to control the newspapers that much because the readership is not as important. I mean, we all know from propaganda that the images are more important than words, and certainly in contemporary universe. So there are other outlets like the New Times and even those newspapers that are favorable or not favorable, they're not anti-Putin necessarily. They still can print some very very biting op-eds. So that's not the point. The point is that Putin is always going for the most outreach. So for 10 years it was TV, and now it seems to be getting the internet. And so they're trying to figure out how to address this issue. Although I still would like to remind the listeners that Russia is as medieval as it is, and I totally agree with Khodorkovsky. It is still a far cry from the Chinese system to manipulate the World Wide Web information.
Well, the one thing that the Chinese and Putin have in common is this wonderful holdover from the communist era, the word hooligan and hooliganism, which is a grab bag term for anybody that they want to railroad. And that is what's being applied to these young women, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it is actually, it's a fantastic point that you just made, because the word hooligan really disappeared from the Russian language for a really long time, because during the Yeltsin era in the 90s, after communism collapsed, hooligan didn't seem like it is such an insult, but it is indeed. I remember in the Soviet Union, hooligan was grounds for prosecution. In fact, a lot of dissidents of the 70s were accused of being hooligans and those without jobs, whatever, the parasites.
So
these were the grounds for offense. And it did seem like a lot of things that we experienced in the Soviet Union and thought they were gone forever in 91, they seemed to come back after 2000 under Putin.
Again, I'm speaking with Nina Krusheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. And she's the author of the forthcoming book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And we're talking about the likely conviction tomorrow of the three young women of the Russian punk rock group Pussy Riot, who may well face 3 years, 3 years in jail, having already spent 5 months in prison. They've also, Putin has gone after Navalny as well, hasn't he? The young sort of nationalist protester, using, I think, a similar tactic that the communist Chinese are using on the great artist Ai Weiwei. You know, aren't they charging him with fraudulent back taxes?
The same thing that, I mean, in a sense, the same thing that he did with Mikhail Khodorkovsky, whom you quoted.
Yeah.
Because it does seem to be this new tactic is to use the accuse everybody of being being a thief and prosecute people on that charge, which also yet again is a great reminder of the Soviet times, not that the Soviets were caring about money that much, but they always imagined that their enemy or the people they perceive as enemy would be doing the same thing as they're doing. That is really quite remarkable that the Putin system always accuses everybody of being a thief. And, you know, I don't have proof of that, but there have been investigations by journalists and, you know, arguably Putin, one of the richest men in the world. So, of course, he only thinks in this kind of terms, is that if I stole, somebody else might be stealing either. But with Navalny, it's you know, it's as idiotic as it is with Pussy Riot, because he already was investigated for stealing some forest, something that I can't even understand what it is exactly he's accused of, because it's so crazy. And it was already that investigation was closed in 2009 for the lack of evidence, and now it's open all over again. I mean, Putin was a KGB man. He at least should invent something better, because it is, if it weren't that horrible and tragic and sad, it would be remarkably farcical what he does.
Well, of course, Navalny came up with a great description of United Russia, Putin's rubber stamp party, as the party of thieves and swindlers. But I've been looking into some of the reports about Putin's finances and the extent to which Roman Abramovich in London is his bag man, and he's appointed his old KGB cronies to head up the big oil and gas monopolies that he's taken over. There is a possibility that if and when he ever retires, because he may well reappoint himself for another 12 years, who knows? But if and when he ever retires, he may well end up one of the richest men on the planet.
Well, and I actually hope that as the Iranian finances are being investigated by the West, I think that it is really about time to start investigating the Russian finances instead of allowing this crooks and thieves live in London and buy out property and whatnot. So I hope if Putin retires, actually they will be if I don't imagine that his life is going to be that peachy. That's why he's staying on, because who knows what is going to happen to him when he's out of the Kremlin. But if he does, then I really hope the investigation comes in and his own crimes will be exposed.
Well, Nina Krusheva, he apparently, one of the reasons he's sticking so assiduously to the Syrian dictator Assad is that, my understanding is that Putin honestly believes he's just as delusional as Assad is. Assad believes that the entire uprising against him by 80% of his own people is a foreign plot, and that somehow the CIA is paying these young Syrians to stand in the street and get shot by snipers and tanks. Putin apparently similarly believes that the protests in Russia, and in particular in Moscow, against him are all being organized by Hillary Clinton. So, I mean, it's pretty delusional, isn't it? He's not, apparently, this is not cynicism on his part. My understanding is that he actually believes this.
Well, to a certain degree, and I wouldn't entirely compare the Russian situation, at least not now, not yet, to Assad. I mean, there's certainly Putin is fearful of Assad's fate, but also we have to remember that that actually about 60% of the Russian population did vote for him. Most of reports of protests did come out of big cities, and it is true that in cities his popularity is, I don't know, maybe 20%, 30 at best. But outside of big cities, in fact, he is rather popular, not because he's such a good president or popular as somebody that people now like, but because, you know, as Russians always say, traditionally, better the devil we know. So in the provinces, which is about 60% of the population, they did vote for him. So his situation for now is still better than Assad. But if he plans to stay for another 12 years, that certainly is going to change. In fact, I believe that it's changing by the minute, and it is no longer 60. It's probably now 50, and then it's going to get less and less and less. But he does, as we talked about at the beginning, he does share... he does seem to have affinity with the worst dictators that universe ever created, either past or present, and that really should give us pause in where Russia belongs and what the future holds.
So the 60% that support Putin, is that just an example of the old sort of eternal divide between the educated urban Russians and the so-called Narod?
To a certain extent, it is, and also, you know, sort of exactly the lifestyle that people have been experiencing, the cities versus smaller towns or villages, for that matter. But to some extent, there's also kind of broader horizon that the city people supposedly have versus those who are in the provinces and don't see as much of the world as the city people do. And in fact, I actually talk to people in various regions, especially in Kaluga region, which is about 4 or 5 hours by car west of Moscow, and they would tell me that no, we don't like Putin, but you know who else? There is no other candidate, and at least Russia is respected now, which is basically the display of power that Putin does is for those people in the provinces, because this muscle playing is very important, you know, that we all follow the Olympics, and it was really interesting to watch that the first medals that the Russians got were the judo medals, the first three medals that Russia got. This judo is that muscle display that Putin himself is very proud of. It's his sport. So the provinces and the population there seem to uphold to this view. But once again, as I said, I think the further it goes, the less support they would probably give Putin, because the longer you stay like this in a unhappening environment, which Russia is, with a stagnant environment, the less you really can hold the country together.
Well, of course, his vanity is such that I understand he's had some Botox work, but
he had a facelift. He had a full facelift. It's not just Botox. It's the
right.
Full
but are you, but. I've noticed some people out here have had one too many, the cut too many.
Oh, absolutely. He's very, no offense to Elizabeth Taylor. She was a wonderful actress and a woman, so she has the right to be vain, but he really is kind of that. I mean, that's what he was offering during the elections. That's what he was offering his people, is that, look at me, look, I am what I am. He really he turned into a very vain, very vain human being. I guess he always has been that. I mean, he was just sort of that small man who all of a sudden discovered his bigness and just can't get over it. But no, the Botox really didn't go well with people generally. I mean, that's how he lost most of us. I mean, most of 40%.
Well, Nina, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Kresheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate, and she was a research fellow at the School of Historical Studies of the Institute of Advanced Study at Princeton University, and served as deputy editor of the East European Constitutional Review at the NYU School of Law. She's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and is the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics, and she's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the meetings today between the Syrian dictator and his Iranian ally. It's like a